Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on nuclear suicide when we come back. You know, the genocidal policy of Global 2000 and the New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. Now our national leaders have subscribed to a plan created by the Club of Rome, the United Nations, the Trilateral Commission, and a whole host and plethora of other lesser policy-making think tanks. And their plan is to reduce the Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years. And that's not a typo. That's correct. It's 90% over the next 50 years. That's why I contend that it's time to stop deluding ourselves into believing that we are going to stop all of these mad scientists and philosophers and preachers and politicians in their insane scheme to enslave the world and to impose a worldwide tyranny, this new world order upon all of us. But we don't have to participate in our own demise. We do not have to help them, finance them, or stand helplessly by and do nothing either. It's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Israel and to stop following after all of these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and to survive this global 2000 New World Order nightmare. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, and it's entertaining. And best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, and click on to the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, we've put that CD package just recently now. We've put it online so that you can go to that page at our website and you can download it directly if you are of a mind to do that. All right, we've been talking about nuclear suicide. Now, remember the book that we reviewed in this section was put out by a fellow named Joel M. Skousen, S-K-O-U-S-E-N, Joel Skousen. And we went through a section that deals with nuclear suicide. That's what he calls it, nuclear suicide. He's a military man himself. He's not of the opinion that nuclear war is necessarily suicidal, but the policies that have now been adopted by the United States have made it suicidal. It guarantees that there will be nuclear war. Originally, since the end of World War II up until about, say, 1980, the plan was MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. You Ruskies over there launch those missiles against us, and before they get here, we will launch our missiles against you. And when it's all said and done, we will both be destroyed, but you're not going to get away with it. Well, now, since 1997, we changed the policy. And we have now unilaterally decided that we will not launch our missiles until all of the Russian missiles have struck here first. That's why it's suicidal, because in a massive first strike, the missiles that are in their silos in North Dakota and Montana and scattered around the world are going to be destroyed in their silos, and so they will not be launched against the Soviet Union. And the only missiles that will be left will be those in the submarines. And we have, on our own initiative, decided that two-thirds of all of the submarines will always be in port. Only one-third will be out on station. Which means that in a massive first strike, the Russians will destroy two-thirds of the submarine ballistic missile fleet in their berths. Only one-third will be left out in the oceans. Now, to take them out, they're going to start with an EMT strike first, which should take out communications here in the West so that the nuclear subs can't launch their missiles. They won't have any targets to launch them against because there'll be no communications. If the plan works as it is scoped out to work, the Russians will launch their missiles against the United States and our nuclear bases worldwide with an EMT strike first, knock out all of our communications, knock out all of our power grid, and we won't be able to retaliate with so much as one missile. Now, that's if their plan goes perfectly. Now, typically, plans don't go perfectly, so the Russians, knowing that they probably won't succeed 100%, are prepared to take on a nuclear counterstrike. And they have prepared a civil defense program over the past 50 years in which they think, they believe, that they can save about 90% of their population, both in Russia and China. They believe, and they have put the money to work, and they have built the hardware, and they have built the civil defense shelters, stocked them with food and water, and they think that, yeah, Moscow might get nuked, and probably 90% of the people killed, but that isn't all the people that's left in the Soviet Union. Yes, we may hit some of their military targets, but that won't be all of them. They're going to strike first, so they're going to have the option of targeting anything that they want to hit. And our President Clinton in 1997 changed our policy and said, we'll absorb that first strike. We will not now launch our missiles on warning. When we know that their missiles are on the way, we will not launch our missiles out of their silos before their missiles get here to destroy our missiles in the silos. That's why Joel Skousen called this nuclear suicide. Because it guarantees the Russians that they're going to get in the first blow. And if the first blow is massive and successful enough, there won't be a second blow. So that's pretty tempting. That's almost like saying, here, you go ahead, you hit me with your first blow, give me the best you've got, and I won't stop you. You know, once the first blow is launched, there might not be a second one. So now, that being the case here in the United States, we have all been raised in our educational system to believe that there is no sunrise after the nuclear war begins. Now, there's a book here I want to bring to your attention, in addition to Skousen's, called Nuclear War Survival Skills. It was published by the United States government. That's right, the United States government. It's called Nuclear War Survival Skills, published in 1987, written by a guy named Cresson H. Kearney. Cresson, C-R-E-S-S-O-N, H. Kearney, K-E-A-R-N-Y. I read you the foreword the other day by Dr. Edward Teller. The original edition was published in September 1979 by the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, a facility of the U.S. Department of Energy. So this is a U.S. government publication. It's entitled Nuclear War Survival Skills. The President of the United States, all the members of Congress, the Supreme Court, all the members of the military and the upper echelons plan to survive nuclear war. They plan it. They have already got all of the facilities, the underground defense, the underground food, clothing, and shelter stockpiled. Locations are made. And it's all done at taxpayer expense. And the reason that I thought I'd put the story out is because it would seem like to me that the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives in Poughkeepsie, New York, in Eureka, California, and in Podunk, Iowa, should at least have the warning that nuclear war is coming and that no one is going to prepare for you. You not only have spent all of your treasure preparing for the elitists, but now we're not even going to tell you that there's a problem. I think that you ought to at least be informed that there's a problem. It is solvable. You can survive nuclear war, and you'd best get after it because you don't have a whole lot of time to get ready. And you're going to have to do the whole thing at your own expense. I'm not going to pay for it for you. The government isn't going to pay for it for you. And I don't think anybody else is. All right, now, I'm going to give you names and numbers and judgments a little later, but I want to start with the credentials of the author. The guy that writes this now is, the introduction to the author is Eugene P. Wigner. His name is Wigner. Eugene P. Wigner is a physicist, a Nobel laureate, and the only surviving initiator of the nuclear age. Now, remember, this is written back in 1979. And all of the people who invented the nuclear bombs, you know, that were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, you know, are dead now. That's long past history, and they're dead and buried, and they're gone. But in 1979, this guy was the last guy left. And so he wrote a little piece about the author, and I think maybe it's worth looking at. He says, when the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission authorized me in 1964 to initiate the civil defense project at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, one of the first researchers that I recruited was Cresson H. Kearney. Most of his life has been preparation, unplanned and planned, for writing this guide to help people unfamiliar with the effects of nuclear weapons to improve their chances of surviving a nuclear attack. During the past 15 years, he has done an unequaled amount of practical field work on basic survival problems without always conforming to the changing civil defense doctrine. So after I returned to my professional duties at Princeton in 1966, the civil defense effort at Oak Ridge National Laboratory was first headed by James C. Bressy, and is now headed by Conrad H. Chester. Both have wholeheartedly supported Kearney's down-to-earth research, and Chester was not only a co-developer of several of the survival items described in this book, but also participated in the planning of the experiments that tested them. Now, Kearney's concern with nuclear war dangers began while he was studying for his degree in civil engineering at Princeton. He graduated summa cum laude in 1937. His Princeton studies had already acquainted him with the magnitude of an explosion in which nuclear energy is liberated, then only a theoretical possibility back in 1937. Then after winning a Rhodes Scholarship, Kearney earned 2 degrees in geology at Oxford, still before the outbreak of World War II. And he observed the effective preparations made in England to reduce the effects of aerial attacks. He had a deep aversion to dictatorships, whether from the right or the left, and during the Munich crisis, he acted as a courier for an underground group helping anti-Nazis escape from Czechoslovakia. Following graduation from Oxford, Kearney did geological exploration work in the Andes in Peru and in the jungles of Venezuela. He has traveled also in Mexico, China, and the Philippines. A year before Pearl Harbor, realizing that the United States would soon be at war and that our jungle troops should have at least as good a personal equipment, food, and individual medical supplies as do exploration geologists, he quit his job with the Standard Oil Company of Venezuela, returned to the United States, and he went on active duty as an infantry reserve lieutenant. Kearney was soon assigned to Panama as the jungle experiment officer of the Panama Mobile Force. In that capacity, he was able to improve or invent and then thoroughly jungle test much of the specialized equipment and rations used by our jungle infantrymen in World War II. And for this work, he was promoted to major and awarded the Legion of Merit. To take his chances in combat in 1944, the author volunteered for duty with the Office of Strategic Services as a demolition specialist, helping to limit the Japanese invasion, then driving into the wintry mountains of northern China. He saw mass starvation and death firsthand. The experiences gained in this capacity also resulted in an increased understanding of both the physical and the emotional problems of people whose country is under attack. Without worrying about the increasing dangers of nuclear war and America's lack of civil defense, caused the author in 1961 to consult with Herman Kahn, then a leading nuclear strategist. Kahn was at that time forming a nonprofit war research organization called the Hudson Institute, and offered him work as a research analyst. 2 years of civil defense research in this think tank made the author much more knowledgeable of survival problems and skills. In 1964, he joined the Oak Ridge Civil Defense Project, and since then, Oak Ridge has been Kearney's base of operations, except for 2 years during the height of the Vietnam War. For his Vietnam work on combat equipment, and also for his contributions to preparations for improving survivability in the event of a nuclear war, he received the Army's Decoration for Distinguished Civilian Service in 1972. This book draws extensively on Kearney's understanding of the problems of civil defense, acquired as a result of his own field testing of shelters and other survival needs, and also from an intensive study of the serious civil defense preparations undertaken by other countries, including Switzerland, Sweden, Russia, and China. He initiated and edited the Oak Ridge National Laboratory translations of the Soviet Civil Defense Handbook and of a Chinese manual, and gained additional knowledge from these two sources. Trips to England, Europe, and Israel also expanded his information on nuclear measures, which contributed to the nuclear war survival skills. However, the book advocates principally those do-it-yourself instructions that field tests have proved to be practical. So the book Nuclear War Survival Skills, which I've reported on in the past, but which I want to bring into conjunction here with nuclear suicide, is to give you the source of information that the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives have to have in order to survive nuclear war, which is now an inevitability. Now, most people here in America, and I suppose most of you around the world, probably have not made much in the way of preparations for nuclear war. I mean, after all, you people in Venezuela or Peru or Ecuador are not prime targets. It's not very likely that most of the people around the world are going to be targeted with a nuclear weapon. But here in the United States and in those countries around the world where American bases are located, you can rest assured that when the attack occurs, you are going to be under the bomb. So if you're living near a Strategic Air Force Command B-52 base in Diego Garcia, you're going to get it there. You might want to think about moving away. If you're living in the country where, like England, France, and Germany, you are sitting close to one of these nuclear bases, then you can rest assured that you're going to be under the nuclear target. I mean, that's just the way life is. Now, if you're living in Czechoslovakia or Poland, or you're living in Romania or the Ukraine, or you're living in, say, South Korea, although South Korea may have a nuclear base or two that I don't know about, or Japan, you probably aren't going to be targeted. Probably. That doesn't mean that you won't be. It just means that probably not. You're probably pretty safe in Tokyo. It's not very likely that the Russians or the Chinese are going to nuke Tokyo, although the North Koreans might. The North Koreans still have something against you Japanese from World War II, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen or when, but you know, there's always these vagaries that come into play. So I'm going to turn over here to chapter 1. And this is an important chapter. Chapter 1, it talks about the dangers from nuclear wars or nuclear weapons, myths and facts. And we here in the West have been fed with a lot of myths. There are true facts concerning nuclear weapons, and then there's a lot of myths that go along with it. So if you've been to public school here in the United States or Canada, Australia, New Zealand, or Western Europe, you probably have been infected with the myths more than the facts. Now, here from the United States government, back in the 1960s, when there was an active civil defense program working here in the United States with the intention of saving the population of America from nuclear war, they wrote a book. And this guy Kearney was in the process, or was one of those that was commissioned to write the book. And it was published by our government. Now, since about 1972, about then, you know, once we were hot and heavy into the Vietnam War, civil defense here in the United States was put on the back burner. By 1980, with the SALT talks, we were told, well, we think that we can successfully disarm. By 1997, unilateral disarmament began in earnest here in the United States. We have disarmed in the face of a nuclear buildup by Russia. We've been told that the Russians are also disarming and that they're destroying their nuclear weapons. That's not true. They have destroyed some of their nuclear weapons for ISAV, you know, for propaganda purposes, but they have a totally separate nuclear agenda that's been going on since the day that the SALT talks started. It's underground, it's secret, and they've already completed it. Now what we're waiting for is that period in time when the Russians and the Chinese reach their maximum apex of power. That is, they've got more nuclear weapons, more missiles, and they're ready to launch them in a surprise attack than we have here in the United States. And at the other side, or on the other side of the coin, when the United States is at its very weakest point, when we have adopted policies and procedures of appeasement to such a degree that we're at our weakest, when we will have the least amount of forces available for a counterattack, and we have adopted policies that are guaranteed to cause us to lose, that's when the nuclear war will start. And Joel Skousen picked about 2009 through about 2015, about a six-year window that we have now entered. We are in that window. Now, the President of the United States, sitting in the White House, has a hardened underground bunker 14 stories below. It has already been hollowed out. It's a bunker 14 stories. That's 140 feet straight down under the White House in the bedrock. Then from there, the President can get on a train and go to Camp David, Maryland. How do you like that? So the minute that a nuclear attack is underway, the President will get in the elevator, go down 14 stories, and get into a train. All of the members of Congress will get out of the Capitol. They'll do the same thing, and they will board their trains all underground. This is a subway system. This is going to underground bunkers prepared for a four-year siege. Already done, bought and paid for, stocked and ready to go. Now, it may be true that some of these guys will get caught, you know, out on the road and they'll get killed. But by and large, the families of the elites now are prepared for nuclear bomb war. They believe they can survive it. Meanwhile, they have educated us in the public school system under the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto to believe that that's impossible and you can't do it. And so Kearney here writes in Chapter 1, Myths and Facts. He starts by saying an all-out nuclear war between Russia and the United States would be the worst catastrophe in history. It's a tragedy. So huge, it is difficult to comprehend. But even so, it would be far from the end of human life on Earth. The dangers from nuclear weapons have been distorted and exaggerated for various reasons. These exaggerations have become demoralizing myths believed by millions of Americans. While working with hundreds of Americans building expedient shelters and life support equipment, I have found that many people, at first, see no sense in talking about the details of nuclear survival skills. Those who hold these exaggerated beliefs about the dangers from nuclear weapons must first be convinced that nuclear war would not inevitably be the end of them and everything that is worthwhile in life. Only after they have begun to question the truth of these myths do they become interested. Now, under normal peacetime conditions, in acquiring nuclear war survival skills, before giving these details and instructions for making and using survival equipment, we should first examine the most harmful of the myths about nuclear war dangers, along with some of the grim facts. So myth number one, fallout radiation from a nuclear war would poison the air and all parts of the environment. It would kill everyone. Now, this is a very demoralizing message of On the Beach and many similar pseudoscientific books, articles, and movies. But the facts are, when a nuclear weapon explodes near enough to the ground, for its fireball to touch the ground, it forms a crater. And many thousands of tons of earth from that crater of a large explosion are pulverized into trillions of little microscopic particles. These particles are contaminated by radioactive atoms produced by the nuclear explosion. Then, thousands of tons of these particles are carried up into a mushroom-shaped cloud many miles above the Earth. These radioactive particles then fall out of the mushroom cloud, or out of the dispersing cloud of particles, which by now is being blown by the winds. This is the fallout. Now, each one of these contaminated particles continuously gives off invisible radiation, much like a tiny X-ray machine. While these particles are in the mushroom cloud, and while descending, and then after having fallen to the earth, the descending radioactive particles are carried by the winds like the sand and dust particles of a miles-thick sandstorm cloud, except that they usually are blown at lower speeds, and in many areas the particles are so far apart that no cloud is seen. The largest, heaviest fallout particles reach the ground first, in locations that are close by to the explosion. Many smaller particles are carried by the winds for tens to thousands of miles before they, too, fall to the earth. Now, at any one place where fallout from a single explosion is being deposited on the ground in concentrations high enough to require the use of shelters, deposition will be completed within just a few hours. The smallest fallout particles, those tiny enough to be inhaled into a person's lungs, are invisible to the naked eye. These tiny particles fall so slowly from the stratospheric heights to which typical Soviet explosions would carry them that the winds carry them thousands of miles away from the site of the explosion before they fall out and reach the ground. The air in properly designed fallout shelters, even those without air filters, is free of radioactive particles, and it is safe to breathe, except in a very few rare environments, which we will cover and explain later. Now, fortunately, for all living things, the danger from fallout radiation lessens with time. The radioactive decay, as this lessening is called, is rapid at first and then gets slower and slower. The dose rate, that is, the amount of radiation received per hour, decreases accordingly. Figure 1.2 illustrates the rapidity of the decay of radiation from fallout during the first 2 days after the nuclear explosion that produced it. R stands for Roentgen, a measurement unit often used to measure exposure to gamma rays and X-rays. Fallout meters, called dosimeters, measure the dose received by recording the number of R. Remember, R stands for Roentgen. Fallout meters, called survey meters or dose rate meters, measure the dose rate by recording the number of R Roentgens being received per hour at the time of measurement. Notice that it takes about 7 times as long for the dose rate to decay from 1,000 Roentgens per hour to 10 Roentgens per hour as to decay from 1,000 Roentgens per hour to 100 Roentgens per hour. Only in high fallout areas would the dose rate 1 hour after the explosion be as high as 1,000 Roentgens per hour. Okay, so let me pause here and let me see if I can pass that one on to you. The closer you are to the nuclear explosion, the more radiation you're going to receive per hour. The further you are away from the explosion, the less radiation you're going to receive per hour. So that the closer you are to the blast, the more protection you have to have. 1,000 Roentgens per hour is a fatal dose. You're going to die. 500 Roentgens per hour, and you're going to get sick, real sick. Awful, god-awful sick. And 80% of you who receive 500 Roentgens will die. That's 80 out of 100 at 500. If we can get you down to 100 Roentgens per hour, which will make you sick, but not fatally so, you can probably survive it. Now, the further you are away from the blast, the less Roentgens per hour you're going to receive, which is why Joel Skousen suggested that you leave San Diego, because San Diego is most assuredly going to be a target. But if you have to live there in San Diego, then you need a shelter with blast doors so that the overpressure doesn't kill you and that you've got the wherewithal that you can survive 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 Roentgens per hour close to the blast site, and you can do that for up to 30 days. The simpler, more logical solution is to move away from San Diego. And that's just common sense. But even though you live there, and as we'll see here a little later, there was a bomb shelter 100 yards from ground zero in Nagasaki, in which the people who were in the bomb shelter all died. But if that bomb shelter had been equipped with a blast door, 100 yards, that's 300 feet from the ground zero, they would have survived the blast. That's why you have to have a blast door if you're going to live close to the blast area. And that's because the blast raises the air pressure from 14 pounds per square inch to 100 pounds per square inch. And that 100 pounds per square inch just crushes you. Just killed you. So, to survive close to the blast area, you have to have a blast door so that the overpressure does not go much above 14 pounds per square inch, which then will save you from the blast. Now, you're going to have the fallout, which is going to fall all around this blast area. Boy, it's going to be heavy duty. Now, the myth is that, you know, this fallout is fatal. Well, it's going to be fatal for the first 30 days. But it dissipates over time. You know, the people from Nagasaki and Hiroshima, they live there today. In fact, there were survivors right after the blast and the fallout. The people of Nagasaki and Hiroshima did not all die. A lot of them did, but not all of them. There were survivors. Naturally, it would have been better had they not been in Hiroshima and Nagasaki when the bombs were dropped, but they survived it anyway. So there are going to be survivors in New York and San Diego and Los Angeles, but not very many. Not very many. So the purpose for the two books, that is Skousen's book here on strategic relocation and Kearney's book on nuclear war survival skills, is to maximize Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife's chance of survival. You don't need to worry about your congressman, your senator, your governor, your Supreme Court justices, the President of the United States. Those people are all taken care of at your expense. It's already a done deal. Sit back and relax. The President's going to survive it. Now, whether you're going to survive it out here in, you know, Fort Sill, Oklahoma, or Tulsa, or Oklahoma City, or Sioux City, Iowa. Now, that's another story of and by itself. You may or you may not, depending upon where you're located at the time that this fallout is coming down upon us. But if you were to take precautions now, you can expand that opportunity or that chance of survival in the future. Now, we're at the halfway point here, and I'm going to have to give you your mid-course reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the law or website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package, which is now available on our website. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, that's for those of you that don't have Internet connections and you listen to this program over a radio station somewhere out there in the world, and you'd like to have a copy of our introductory CD package, then write to us, or you can call us at that number and ask for one. We'll send it to you. If you're online, you can write to us and we'll send you one, or you can just download it, or you can watch it right there on your computer screen. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, they don't necessarily mean that the authors and publications that we're endorsing and recommending are going to reciprocate. We should all keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book, Nuclear War Survival Skills. Now, I've done that before, but I'm doing it in conjunction with Joel Skousen's book on nuclear suicide. Now, remember, Skousen's book, you can get by telephone call. It's 801-224-4746. Once more, that's area code 801-224-4746, and Skousen's email is joels@joelskousen.com. That's joels@joelskousen.com. Now, the second publication is much bigger and much more comprehensive. It's about 282 pages, just looking here at the last page. And it's 8.5 by 11. It is a survival book with all kinds of detailed drawings, sketches. It was originally put out by the Department of Energy at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, for the Army and the military application. How do soldiers survive out in the field? And it was upgraded to include the civilian population and shows you how to dig and build, for instance, a fallout shelter right in your backyard with a shovel. Now, it would be much better for you if you would prepare a little better than that. But, you know, if you get down to where push comes to shove and you know, you have to do it with a shovel, it can be done. Now, up front, in Chapter 1, they give myths and answers, myths and facts. And so I started off and I said, let's take a look at the fallout itself. The fallout dissipates over time and over area or distance. Now, let me give you an illustration and I'll show you what we're talking about. Let's suppose that a nuclear weapon, 20 megatons in size, is dropped on Tulsa, Oklahoma. Where I'm located right here, I'm going to use my own experience and my own house, my own location here as an example. Here in southern Missouri, over the Ozark Plateau, based upon the prevailing winds, there will be no fallout here where I live in Isabella, Missouri. There is one other safe area in the United States that probably will not receive any nuclear fallout. That's Northern California, from about Santa Rosa north to the Oregon border. Then a piece of real estate in Oregon, that's Western Oregon, west of Portland, stretching all the way from Coos Bay and all the way north to Astoria. And then that region of Washington State on the west side of Seattle, from Puget Sound to the mouth of the Columbia River, which you could almost virtually be assured that there will be no fallout that falls on that area of the United States. There's a few other odd areas in the United States that probably, like our area here in southern Missouri, will not get any fallout, but it's not guaranteed because the wind changes in its direction. Now, on the west coast of California, the wind blows from the ocean over the landmass, and there I have never seen an exception to that. I suppose it could happen, but it hadn't happened yet. Now, here where I live, we can get wind on odd occasions, either north, south, east, or west. The prevailing wind here is from the west. So this is what tells us that if a bomb is dropped on Tulsa, the drift from it should fall on either side of this location here in the Ozarks. Not guaranteed. So we need a fallout shelter here. Now, the further away from the blast that we are, the less fallout we're going to receive. So in a blast in Tulsa, the 1,000 Roentgens is going to fall around the Tulsa area in a cigar-shaped fallout pattern, which will ultimately reach here. By the time it reaches here, it could be in the 20, 30, 50, maybe even up to 100 Roentgens, maybe. If the wind is just right and it hits us, we need to be prepared for it for up to 2 weeks. So we need an underground shelter stocked with food and water, with an air filter that filters out the particles, that we can hole up in for 2 weeks until the radioactivity dissipates. In the shelter, we need a dose meter that you can buy at Radio Shack for $135. So if you're of a mind to do this, you go to Radio Shack and you get a dose meter, a radiation meter. Then you can use your potato. Here we have fallout shelters that are already built for us. They're called tornado shelters. Tornado shelters. Now, they will have an air intake at the top of it. We also call them root cellars. So many of you people here in the Midwest, you've already got a tornado shelter. But what you're going to need is an air filter over the standpipe. Because if you just leave the standpipe open, you're going to have particles coming into your shelter, much diminished, but they're going to get in. And you're going to be breathing these radioactive particles. Now remember, the further the particles are from the blast site, the smaller they are. And those are the ones you're going to be breathing, like plutonium, which is going to give you cancer later on. You need to filter them out. Now, Joel Skousen also has a guide for where to buy these filters. Don't expect to buy one that you plug into the wall, because there probably won't be any electricity. Probably. So you need to have a manual operated air filtration system in your tornado shelter. Now, tornado shelters are not very big. And for 6 or 8 people in your family to survive for 2 weeks in a tornado shelter, you want to remember that 6 or 8 people have to urinate and defecate. There has to be a means by which you can dispose of your waste. There has to be food and water for all of those people in there. Now, if you'll remember the story about Noah's flood, God locked Noah into the ark 7 days before the flood began. Noah, remember, already had food and shelter and clothing for a protracted period of time. Now, the flood lasted for 1 year, but Noah had to have at least a 2-year supply in the ark. Two. Because, you know, the day he got out of the ark, he couldn't just go out and start picking grapes off of the vines, could he? As a matter of fact, he had to go out and plant the vines, which take 5 years to mature. So Noah had to have more than enough supplies, food, clothing, and shelter, for him to live off of while he was outside the ark planting and getting, you know, scoped out for the rest of his life. Now, we're all going to have to do the same thing. And the people that are outside the ark, when the water starts to get up around their knees, are all going to want to get into the ark right away. Boys and girls, there is not room for everybody in the world in the ark. Which is why Noah had to be locked into the ark a little early. And you're going to find a lot of people knocking on your door asking you to let them into your fallout shelter. Now, depending upon the size of it, if you think that you have the resources to produce a fallout shelter for 100 or 200 or 500 or 1,000 people, by all means, build one that size. It will be of great benefit for you. It will be of great benefit for your neighbors and your friends and extended family and relatives and strangers and sojourners. If you could provide for 100, 200, 500, or 1,000 people food, clothing, and shelter for up to 2 weeks to 30 days in an underground bunker built for, bought, and paid for with your money, that would be wonderful. And I wish I had you for a neighbor. I like people like you. Now, unfortunately, boys and girls, all of us have limits to our financial ability, our physical abilities, you know, everything considered. And you may not be able to provide for another 10, 20, 30, 50 people. Maybe you can only survive this with your own family, which is a pretty tall order. If every American family could take care of just one American family, they would be doing a big job all by themselves. Now, most of you people listening to me have already changed the radio dial. A few of you are skeptical and you're still listening, but you're saying to yourself, my God, this guy has just totally gone off the deep end. I'm not here to convince you that you should build a fallout shelter and listen to me and that I'm right and you're wrong. I don't have any duty to persuade you that you should build a fallout shelter. I thought this was a neat story. I went through Strategic Relocation, written by Joel Skousen. He has a section in there starting on page 122 that deals with nuclear suicide. I read the story. And I said, oh, my God. And the story begins in the year 2009, which is the year 2009, and there's a six-year window. Now, Skousen may be wrong, and we may not have a nuclear bomb war over the next 6 years. And God love him. I hope you're right. I hope we don't have this. I would like to live my life, die of old age, with my shoes off, in bed, in the middle of the night, of natural causes, so that I don't have to live through this. But, you know, Noah, I'm sure, would have said to you, I hope that this is an aberration, and that my 120 years of preparation is for no good purpose. I hope that when it's all said and done, the people on planet Earth, or enough of them, will repent and turn God from his fierce wrath, and that I don't have to spend the next year cooped up in this ark, feeding all these animals and caring for them, trying to survive this worldwide flood. I hope that doesn't happen. In his case, his worst fears were fully materialized, and he had to actually do it. Now, he did it, and he survived it, which is great for him, and it's great for all of us, because all of us are his descendants. And had he failed, you and I wouldn't be here today to talk about our problem with nuclear war survival skills. Now, we've eliminated the people that shut us off at the beginning, and we've eliminated most of you people out there who say this guy's probably a nutcase. Now, there's probably a few of you people who are sitting there on the edge of your seat, and you're sitting there saying, oh my God, this is so big, I don't think I can do it. Now, for those of you that say, well, this is so big, I don't think I can do it, that's not quite true. Even if you're a truck driver and you're making, you know, $30,000 a year, I think, Bob, if you would stop smoking those Marlboros for a couple of weeks. Now, cigarettes are pushing, oh, hell, they're over $3 a pack. I saw cigarettes the other day for $25 a carton. That's $2.50 a pack. So let me just plug this in. $135 for a meter, okay? $135 divided by $2.50 a pack. That's buying them by the carton. 54 packages of cigarettes in 54 days, Bob. That is 60 days. In 60 days' time, if you'll stop smoking for 60 days, you can buy a dose meter. That's a step in the right direction. So when I hear people say, geez, I can't afford it, I'm just barely getting by now. Hey, listen, you got to choose between the dose meter and cigarettes. That's all. You know, if you quit drinking a little beer, you know, on Friday night for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, you probably could afford it. That's step number one. Now, step number two, you need a couple of copies of these books. Now, I would guesstimate that Strategic Relocation is $30. And this other book here called Nuclear War Survival Skills, I bought this quite a few years ago. I'm guessing $30. Hell, if it cost you $100. Okay. I think you can probably get this at Barnes & Noble. Now, take a look here at Nuclear War Survival Skills. The guy's name is Cresson H. Kearney, and that's spelled Cresson H. Kearney. Now, I walk into Barnes & Noble, and I say, hey, I need the book. Here's the title, and here's the guy's name. They plug it into their computer, and almost inevitably, they come up with the book. All right. Now, just in case, for some reason, that ain't quite enough, here's the Library of Congress catalog number. Give the guy this catalog number. It's number 87-60790. Again, that's 87-60790. That's called the Library of Congress catalog number. Now, there's a second number in books. It's called the ISBN number. ISBN number. And in this book, it's called O-94-2487-01-X. All right, so you get that one down. The ISBN number is 0-94-2487-01-X. All right. Now, with that much information, those two books, if you'll stop smoking, save your $2.50 a day, over the next 90 days, you will have enough money to buy a dose meter, the book on strategic relocation, and the book on nuclear war survival skills. Now, that's all I've got. Total. The whole thing. I have prepared to survive nuclear bomb war with those three items. I think I can do it. I may be wrong. There could be a nuclear weapon launched against Kansas City that misses its target and falls on our post office in Isabella, Missouri, in which case I will fail. There's a little doubt in my mind that I will have at that point failed in my goal. But, if the Russians are successful and their missile does in fact hit Kansas City, then it missed Isabella. And as long as they miss Isabella, I got a chance. And hey, by the way, you've got a chance too. All of us have a chance. If you think that FEMA is going to save you, take a look at New Orleans and then reconsider. If you think your government is going to save you, take a look at the mess in the world today, economically, politically, socially, militarily, and then forget that. It ain't going to happen. If you're going to save anybody, you're going to save yourself at your expense, after you've already provided all of this for the elites. The president, the Congress, everybody's been prepared for and provided for. The only guy left now is Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. That's you and me. You're either going to do it for yourself or it ain't going to get done. All right, so there's the first part. Now I'm out of time, so I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-sectarian, non-commercial, it's a private law school, and open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.